Hello, Dental Online Trainers, and welcome to the Dental Online Training Sharecast. I'm your host, Dr. Dennis Hartley. Each month, we'll talk with dental experts who are doing amazing work in the world of dentistry. Also, occasionally, I'm going to throw in a few of my solo Bonnie Sharecasts, where I share a little with you about what I've learned along the way during my career. So tune in the first Tuesday of every month to hear the latest episodes. Hey, Dental Online Trainers, welcome back to our continued conversation. I hope you enjoyed part one. If you haven't had a chance to listen, then why don't you go on back and listen to that, and then join us for this part two of our continued conversation. I think this is one of the great things about going off to college. And so same thing, growing up in this very blue-collar community, going off to college, you meet people, just different socioeconomics, different races, different religions, and just expands, you know, for many of us. And there's others who grew up in cosmopolitan towns and they experience that younger. But for me and for a lot of people, I think it's really the first time that you get to experience that. And I think that's one of the greatest values of university, going to college. Right. And you're doing it at an age where you're still, I think, very malleable and you're very open to understanding others and stuff. Maybe, you know, better at that age than sort of at my age when things are kind of locked in.
You get to be a grumpy old man.
Get off my yard, kids, right? That guy. When you're going through dental school, let me fast forward, because here's one of the things I want to ask. I don't want to forget to ask. So coming from blue collar, and I've talked to other dentists about this, one of the challenges is if you want to start doing higher end dentistry, you're going to ask patients fee level, things that my family personally could not afford, right?
Absolutely. So,
and that was one of my big struggles, and to some degree still is a little bit today, but not nearly as much as it was in the beginning. Did you have that issue as you started doing higher end dentistry, sort of coming to terms with the fact that you're going to be charging a fee that's beyond maybe what you would be able to afford? You didn't have the ski kit, right? And now you're asking patients to pay a fee that's, you know,
one off.
Yeah, right. That is.
You know what? I did not.
Oh.
And that might be an English thing, because I think in England, and this is a difference between England and maybe America, in so much as if you're blue collar, yeah, okay, you're going to be inhibited about asking for money, because, you know, you're talking about a treatment plan that's more than your dad earned in a year.
Exactly.
That's the bottom line.
Yep.
So that's going to be inhibiting. But if you're not blue collar, if you're from the English middle or upper classes in England, talking about money is a massive taboo subject.
Mm-hmm.
Massive.
Yeah.
Like, it's not the done thing. So you're handicapped both ways in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So I know in the U.S., I've certainly noticed this because I travel in the U.S. and teach in the U.S., quite commonly, I've noticed that Americans are much less inhibited about talking about money generally. Like, for example, if you mention your income in England, that's considered to be super low class. But people are relatively comfortable about that in the US. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's different.
Yeah.
And people will discuss the price of their house, the price of their car, what they've got in retirement savings, stuff like that. If you're from the US, if you're English, you really don't do that. And that's good and bad. So I don't think being blue collar was a handicap for that, to be honest. And I've never really had a problem talking about money.
Yeah.
Patients. No, not at all. I guess the major obstacle was really a little bit of imposter syndrome when I was younger.
I know very few people who don't feel that, right? I still feel imposter syndrome still to this day, right? I think it's one of the challenges.
I don't feel it now, but I certainly did when I was younger. But it's difficult, isn't it? It's like, why the hell am I here?
Yeah, for sure.
But I don't know, Dennis. I think in a way, having a blue collar background is kind of an advantage. Right.
Once
you get over all this bullshit, let's be honest, you probably have to put that out. Once you got over all that angst, you're then in a situation whereby, okay, you're now a professional person, you're in a certain income bracket, you're educated. So therefore, you can speak on a level with people from higher socioeconomic backgrounds, because you don't have same income as all of them, but you know, kind of okay. But you can also speak with a level of understanding and empathy for people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, because I didn't always do high-end dentistry. When I began, I worked in the National Health Service, which is, for those of you from the US, if you imagine the worst possible insurance and then divide it by 10, it's that one.
That's public aid. That's our public aid.
Yeah. Yeah. So I did that at the beginning. Now, if I was from a more middle stroke upper class background and I present, I don't know, a broken down tooth and somebody needs a crown, and I present that to them, and they're giving off signals and they're using language that says, I don't want to do that because I can't afford it.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. But they never vocalize that.
For sure.
Because it's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing. Absolutely.
Yeah. If I wasn't from a blue collar background, I can't really say for sure because I haven't been in this position, but I'm guessing I would find it more challenging to pick that up than somebody from my background. And I can see it because I've seen my dad and my mom in that position where they've been, you know, oh, you know, you should do this or you should do that. And they've backpedaled and given a reason, which is not the exact reason for not doing it.
And but the bottom line was they just couldn't afford it.
The bottom line is it costs more money than I've got spare that month. Yeah. I'm looking at the money I've got because I got to pay for, I don't know, a football for my kid or school uniform or whatever. I got to buy a dinner or whatever.
Exactly. The house needs repairs.
I got to buy a boiler for the house. So that's going to screw me for 3 months or whatever.
Exactly. Right. You know, real world situation.
I kind of get it. Yep. So it's not especially helpful for me in my current office because, frankly, most of my patients are quite wealthy and frankly, most of them are more wealthy than I am by a long stretch.
Sure.
So I'm back being the poor kid, I guess.
Yeah, right.
In a different way. But it was certainly more helpful in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about your path. How'd you get into doing the cosmetic work that you're doing, especially with the composite stuff? Who influenced you? Where how did you start moving through this path, this journey?
So I won't bore you with the initial stuff, but
initial stuff's good.
We talk about kind of learning them. I have good hand skills for restorative dentistry. All right. That's the bottom line. I've been told that repeatedly. I do not have good hand skills for things like endo. I don't know why, but I'm like at the left of the bell curve for endo.
I'm same. If I can't see it, I can't do it. I don't have that feel for endo.
Two thumbs on one left hand for endo.
I'm same. Same.
With restorative, particularly indirect, oddly, my hands just seem to move and they don't. I don't really have to think about it. It's a weird feeling. It's kind of like I'm in the zone. Mm-hmm. And I kind of always been like that. And what happened is when I was younger at dental school, one of the professors in restorative and pros picked up on that. And he was like, I think you should go and your career pathway should be at being an academic at the Eastman Dental Hospital in London, which was a pretty serious place academically in England. And they set me up with people there from being in the fourth year at dental school. So they kind of had my whole life planned out there. And then they were like, well, you're never going to make any money doing that. You won't be able to support a family. So part-time, you want to work in a high-end office in London. And there were a couple of guys, a guy called Willie Lloyd, who was one of my tutors there, who had a Plowman and Partners. It's the oldest office in the country. It's like 2 years old.
Wow.
And they were like, okay, well, if you go and work at the Eastman, you know, you can come and work a couple of days in our office and it's pretty good.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. So I had the dream ticket right from 2 years out, which not bad from the working class boy from the, project. But the plan was in the beginning, you have to do a fellowship exam and it involves a lot of medicine. So if you're smart, you go and do a oral maxillofacial job.
Okay.
Because it involves more medicine than doing perio or restorative or whatever, a residency. So I'm offered the dream ticket, which people, you know, as a 52-year-old guy, if I was offered that now, I'd be tearing that arm off, right?
No doubt, right?
Okay, yeah, because it's like, how good could it get? So I did oral surgery for 2 years, and I was like, nah, I don't want your great golden ticket. You can keep that.
So naive and dumb. God.
As a 25-year-old kid.
Opportunities wasted on the youth.
I'm a neurosurgeon, and you can screw your pros. God. So can you believe I did that with the arrogance of it? Unbelievable. Right. The arrogance of youth, I guess.
Yes, so true.
So I went and did oral surgery for 3 years. And then I don't know if it's the case in the US, but you have to do medicine to do MaxFac seriously in the UK. I got a place in medical school, and then I met my wife.
Then you made a pivot.
And then I made a pivot. But actually, the other thing I missed out. So part of this golden ticket was also to go off and do an MS in either pros or perioprost in the US.
Okay. And
the colleges they were suggesting, which they could have gotten me into because they had like one visiting UK guy a year.
Okay.
Was like in Ann Arbor, and the other
that's
one
my school.
Penn, and the other one was Penn.
Two good choices.
Yeah. So in the beginning, I was like, okay, screw your golden ticket with your USMS, with the sponsorship, living costs paid for. I don't need that. I'm going to be a oral surgeon. Then I get in to do oral surgery in Guy's Hospital, which is another decent hospital in the UK. Then I met my wife, and I'm like, I don't want to do that anymore. I'm going to go and be a general practitioner. And how old was I? About 27. I was like, well, I've done oral surgery for like 3 years, and I'm like king of the world, and I'm amazing. And what's going to happen is when I go into practice, I'm going to do oral surgery in practice, a bit of dentistry. And they're going to be queues of people queuing up, wanting me to take their wisdom teeth out and stuff like that.
Of course.
Guess what? I went to job interviews out of hospital residency. And I kind of gave them this shtick, you know, I can come in and take all the teeth out of your nice, genteel office. And I was surprised that a lot of office owners went, do you know what? I'll give you a call sometime. Oh, okay. Never did.
Wow.
They basically didn't want some idiot coming in and doing loads of extractions in their office and people sitting with fat faces and bleeding in their weight room, which we as older guys now, it's freaking obvious.
Of course. As a young guy, you think you got the answer to civilization.
Like, why don't they want me?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So then I got a job interview with a guy called Jeremy, who was one of my early mentors. And he's retired now, retired 2 years ago. But he was in Cornwall, which is where I am now. Mm-hmm. And nobody wanted to go to Cornwall. Because
same problem in the US. People don't want to go to these rural communities.
It's in the ass end of nowhere. It's basically, if you imagine like working on the Cape. It's kind of like that, but not kind of as, well, I guess it is as touristy now, but it wasn't then. It was just like nowhere near a dental school, nowhere near London. Mm-hmm. You know, my town, the sole entertainment in my town was one fish and chip shop and a 2-screen cinema. That was it.
Dang.
So it's not racked out with young people. So I got a job interview with Jeremy, and he was like, yeah, okay, let's do this. And he was a good restorative guy, actually. So I went in his office and he was doing fee-for-service and I was in the other room doing essentially Medicaid. We were mainly doing acrylic and amalgam then.
Sure.
And extractions. And then he said to me, okay, well, there's this guy coming to London from the US called Larry Rosenthal. And he's like kind of a veneers guy. And we went and watched it, and that was good and bad. And I was like, I'm going to go back to my office, to our office, and do these ceramic veneers on all our Medicaid patients.
What year was that? What year did you see Larry?
I wouldn't have been 30. So it would have been a good 20, 25 years ago.
And for those in the audience who don't know that name, Larry Rosenthal was one of the pioneers in porcelain veneers. And if you know Michael Appa, Appa learned under Larry. So he really, there are others who are very involved with porcelain veneers, but Larry was sort of the dentist of the stars back in the day.
Exactly that. So then I went back to the office and started presenting all these big cases to these Medicaid patients. And I was surprised to see them running out the door.
I can't. How's that possible?
So, yeah. So I was super dumb, basically. And then after a few months, Jeremy took me aside and he said, you're going to have to stop doing this because we're not going to have an office left, yeah. Which was tough love. But I wanted to do it. I was really inspired by it. So basically, the bottom line is I thought, oh, I can't do it in ceramic. Can I do it in resin? So 20 odd years ago, I started doing it in resin.
Interesting.
And I guess out of necessity, I was probably, I wasn't the first by any stretch of the imagination, but I was certainly the first in my area. I was probably one of the first in the UK to do it with composite on a fairly regular basis. Not because of a love of resin, not because of any advantage of resin, just because it was a material my patients could afford. And when we began, we had what we call case of the month. Like one person would suck up for it and go, yeah, I'll do it.
Okay.
And I used to schedule Friday morning and I'd do my one case.
Interesting.
And I always tell this to the younger people I mentor, don't expect to have a pile of cases just flying in your door, because right. I spent a couple of years doing case of the month.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the time, I would go back and do my amalgam and my acrylic Medicaid.
Yeah.
And then I'd get my other case of the month. And then the case of the month's wife might come. And then the case of the month's wife's brother. And then before long, after about 2 years, it became case of the week. And then once you get to case of the week, it becomes case of the day pretty quick after that. The jump from case of the month to case of the week takes a long time, a couple of years. With my sales skills, it did anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think that's typical growth for this type of practice. It's very slow, right? It's very linear. Then all of a sudden you hit that tipping point. You hit the tipping point and then it's exponential. Yep.
And then you reach, and then case of the week goes to case of the day pretty quick. And then before you know it, you're like, all right, so you don't want a mouth of veneers.
Right. Yeah.
So that's how it works. But you have to, the bottom line is, and you've probably been through this as well, I guess. You got to spend that 2 years in the trenches. That's the tough bit.
Yep.
That's the grind. That's the one person out of every 30 or 40 is going to say yes. So it's really, really, really easy to get disheartened. And the important thing is to just keep asking the question and it will happen eventually. And then from that, I morphed from composite resin to ceramic, and now I do both.
Sure. Who influenced you when you were learning your composites?
Okay, so we were both influenced a little bit by Buddy.
Yeah, for
Buddy
sure.
Buddy was more... Buddy, actually, I saw Buddy in London a bit later on, and Buddy was more influential in terms of teaching.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. In terms of actually doing... There was a young, fresh-faced guy around at the time called Newton Fall.
Yeah.
And I learned quite a lot from him. And then also we had a guy called Lorenzo Vanini.
So good.
And so good. Didier. They're the ones that influenced me right at the beginning.
Yeah, Didier and Vanini, they were in Europe, I think, probably the two that were really sort of setting composites ablaze.
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 They were doing crowns with composite, basically.
Right. So skilled.
That's kind of where I got that.
And I think they were probably really super artful in stratification and layering and sort of understanding sort of the Denton buildup and stuff like that, that Newton also was doing really just at such a high level.
Yeah. And in Europe, it's kind of reached, I don't know if you've ever met Lorenzo, but Lorenzo is a polymath. He's a concert level pianist, he's an artist, blah blah blah. So it comes all that it come there's a little move away from dentistry to it being your dentistry being part of your life and being an art form, which sounds, I'm almost chewing my lip as I say it because it sounds almost pretentious, but it makes your job a creative part of your life, which I kind of enjoy.
Yeah. I'm so blessed. I didn't know that dentistry had that aspect to it. I didn't know that I had that in me, that I needed that, or that it was fulfilling to me, and that it just sort of happened that way. I think just dumb luck, you know, because it is. It's so there's something visceral about it. Like you talked about when you're prepping teeth, how your hand just sort of knows to go, right? And yeah. I think when you get comfortable with composite dentistry, there's something visceral about it, just internal. The materials, they sort of know where they want to go.
See the shade and the thickness.
Yeah, it's just music, yeah. You know? It's just music. It's just layering and just...
Really work with a 15 endo file. I don't know why, but
yeah, I think for endodontists, I think for some people it is that. I think they have that symphony going when they're doing that and they get that. But same with me, I could never do that with surgery or with endo and stuff. It was different.
Usually a file breaks. That's my first.
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah. Hey, don't even get me started with endo.
The apical third.
I have such respect for my endodontists though, because I always just struggled as much effort and practice I put into it. It was never magic for me.
And the more strategic the tooth is, the more likely it is to screw up.
Isn't that the truth? That's so true.
It's always somebody's upper central.
Exactly, right? Or you need it for a bridge abutment or something. It's like, yeah, good God.
Away with the tip of that. Where did that file look suddenly shorter?
Then you blame your assistant. What did you do with the tip? How'd you break that tip? No, thank you anymore. No, thank you. Jason, I want to roll this up. And so what advice would you have for young dentists? And we were talking about this before we started recording, mm-hmm. about the realities of young dentists in dental world today. And I know it's different from European countries and in the U.S. countries, where a lot of our dentists are coming out $500,000 in debt. And and I don't know what the pressures are for a corporate dental world in the UK and other places. I don't think it's as bad as it is in the US, but I think it's coming.
I think it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are your thoughts? And what are your advice? I guess your thoughts and your advice.
Well, I think the first thing is you need a mentor.
Right.
Or in fact, you need mentors, plural. And you need mentors not only for, you know, I mentor some people, but they a lot of people think mentoring is, so I got a case. How do I handle this case? And yeah, that could be useful as a mentor, but also the mentor should be able to talk to you about your professional attitude, how you practice, what sort of education you should be thinking about, how you should manage patients, how you should manage your own life so that you can work in the best way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I'm seeing a fair few of the younger dentists I mentioned, in my opinion, and this sounds terrible for me, actually spend too much time on dentistry.
Mm.
And that might be shocking coming from me, but actually I think you need to spend a lot of time with your family and your friends and also on yourself and with hobbies, so that when you go back and do that dentistry, you're focused and you can do it to a higher end.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things, I think, mentoring. The other thing, and this is something that we did not experience, I'm seeing it with my own children at the moment, not with dentistry, but just with things generally, is don't get too hooked up on social media.
I know, right?
Because I think social media has been great for dentistry, because it's, from my point of view, it's enabled me to hook up with people I probably wouldn't have met,
yep.
were it not for social media. It's enabled me to see lots of different techniques and different thoughts, and that's really good. It's enabled a lot of postgraduate education in fairly innovative ways, which is also cool.
Yep.
But that's a good side. The flip side is a lot of it's fake, kids. Yeah. A lot of these cases, a lot of these wow cases, I see cases. I've spoken to people who've spent 7 hours doing a class one. Right. 7 hours.
Right. Right.
Doing
right.
a class one. Now, in a way, that's good, because it shows you what's possible at the extreme end, at the extreme right of the bell curve. But most dentists, and I include myself in that most definitely, are not going to spend 7 hours doing a class one and photographing it and videoing it for Instagram and then going back with all those images and all that media and then manipulating it into some kind of video so that you can have your literally 2 days of fame for that case on Instagram.
Right.
And you're the big I am for that day. You're, as Warhol said, famous for 15 minutes, literally. Right. I'm hearing from a lot of younger dentists, because I spend a lot of time with younger dentists. I'm not a good dentist. And I'm like, why? Well, because I can't do a case like that.
Right. Yep.
And I'm like, my response to that dentist is actually the person who made that video can't do a case like that either in the real world.
In the real world.
In the real world. And this is just fake. And this is, I feel this is the biggest cause of anxiety in younger dentists as far as I've seen. And I think in a way that's sad. And I think, okay, watch these videos. It's cool.
Yep.
It's like, I guess it's kind of like dental pornography.
It is, for sure.
It's not real, right?
It's not real.
Except for that. You know, go back to your office, maybe modify a few things, you know, put rubber dam on maybe, spend a bit more time on the prep, blah, blah, blah. But do it in a realistic fashion so that the patient, I mean, I can't imagine a patient wants to sit in a chair for 7 hours for a class one.
No.
Do it so you can make a living.
Yep.
And do it so it doesn't exhaust you, because the stress you're creating when you're trying to create something to that level in yourself is tremendous.
Absolutely.
You can't do that on a daily basis. That's just insane.
No, so and you can't run a practice like that. You can't survive.
I don't know. I mean, let's be honest, Dennis, between us, we know people who run some of the highest end practices in the world, period. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I don't know any of them that would do that.
No.
It's a vanity project for Instagram, right? And that's okay. If you want to do that for a hobby, that's fine. But that's literally what it is. It's a hobby.
Right. And that's 99.9% of dentists are doing this because they need to make a living. So let's be able to create nice dentistry for our patients. But let's be realistic that we don't have all day to do a single restoration. It's not reality in my practice.
I don't think it's reality in any serious dentist practice, to be honest.
Yeah.
So that's my other advice. My third bit of advice is value yourself and your family above everything else.
Right. That's great advice.
They're the three things.
A little self-love is important, right?
Not too much.
A little bit.
A little bit.
Because I think dentistry tends to, and I don't know what dental education
does.
You know, when I was in school, and you probably experienced the same, you know, I remember asking an instructor, and it was one of our early preclinic preparation courses. And I said, if I were making the mistake of leaving, if I was going to err and leaving the provisional a little long or a little short, which way should I err? And he said, don't err. This is dentistry. You're not supposed to err.
I kind of get that. But I think,
get it. But that also sets you up that everything's got to be perfect. And I think in our profession, the perfection's not possible. It's a ridiculous, elusive concept. We just want to be excellent. We want to be really good. And just to pardon yourself and excuse yourself, you know, and allow yourself that we're all human. We're all trying to get a little bit better.
As a profession, I think we peck ourselves to death.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's even in older, experienced dentists, you know, it's just not good enough. Peck, peck, peck. And then you go home and you're still stressing about a freaking margin on a class two composite. So it's like, geez, you know, there are people starving in the world.
They're right
on the streets. You know, there are people who haven't got shoes, and you're worrying about, you know, a micron, a margin on a class two resin. It's just, you know, get over it. It's not
be a little forgiving.
Yeah. So there we are.
Jason, I can't thank you enough for spending the time with us. It's been great catching up with you, and I'm looking forward to seeing you next week.
Yeah, I'll bring a few bottles of wine.
All right. It's going to be brilliant. Good.
It'll be good.
So we'll catch up some more then. For my dental online trainers, this has been great. And as you know, it's all about sharing. And as Jason brought up, it's about mentorship and seeking mentorship, but also offering mentorship and guiding those. So for those who've been out a little bit, offer mentorship. And for those who are younger, seek out mentorship. I would not be able to practice the type of dentistry I'm doing today if it wasn't for seeking out mentorship and having such great people around me and being able to have people like Jason Smithson in my life and all these other people I've been able to be fortunate to speak with. So, Jason, I admire your dentistry. I admire you as a person. I think you're just awesome. Why don't you just give a plug for where you're going to be coming up speaking and doing your stuff, especially in the U.S.?
I'm in the U.S. a few times next year, actually. Funny enough, I've got my diary in front of me, which is very full. I'm away to Speer with Speer ECR, which is excellent in composite resin restorations. That's at the back end of April of this year coming. And then we have Speer Summit. And then I'm back in the U.S. with Cosmodent in Chicago, which is the last weekend in June of this year, June 29th, 30th. Sorry about my dogs. I'm back at Speer 16th, 17th, and 18th of August. Yeah. And then I'm with a group called Dental Nachos in Philadelphia.
Oh, fun.
Do you know, Paul?
I a little bit.
On 13th, 14th of October. So they're my US trips. So if you can make time, it'd be nice to see you there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you all. This is just a great opportunity. And Jason, can't wait to see you in just a week or so. Yeah. So for all of us out there, all our Dental Online trainers, thanks for joining us for the Sharecast. And as always, yours for better dentistry. I'm Dr. Dennis Hartlieb. Well, thanks so much for listening or viewing our Sharecast today. If you enjoy this and you want to get more information from Dental Online Training, then check us out at dothandson.com. That's one word, dothandson.com. Now, as a reminder, DOT has so many other great opportunities for your learning. We have our Wine and Unwind monthly webinars where we engage real time with our viewers as we bring in leaders throughout the dental industry to bring you up-to-date information and answer your questions. We have our monthly coffee and donut study club sessions where our participants bring in cases and we treatment plan these cases together to help you bring great treatment to your patients. We have our live virtual workshops where our dental online trainers perform the same techniques from their kits as I'm doing from the comfort of their own home or office. We have our blogs and we have endless selection of our hands-on pre-recorded technique courses to help you improve the clinical dentistry they can provide for your patients. That's right. With our on-demand courses, you do these hands-on exercises when the time is right for you. So check us out on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn at Dental Online Training. And hey, be sure to share this with your friends and colleagues who you think might benefit from the Sharecast and everything that DOT has to offer. And now, how about one of those coveted 5-star ratings? Please go to your site and help us by getting the word out to others. And we'd welcome one of those wonderful 5-star ratings. This episode was created with special help from Claire O'Neill. It was edited by Ashley Dixon Ellison and with original music by Chris Peterson. Again, thank you for listening. I'm Dr. Dennis Hartlieb, yours for better dentistry.